An incomplete list. No more diving into pools of chlorinated water lit green from below. No more ball games played out under floodlights. No more porch lights with moths fluttering on summer nights. No more pharmaceuticals. No more certainty of surviving a scratch on one's hand. No more flight. No more towns glimpsed from the sky through airplane windows, points of glimmering light. No more looking down from 30,000 feet and imagining the lives lit up by those lights at that moment. No more countries, all borders unmanned. No more fire departments, no more police, no more road maintenance or garbage pickup. No more spacecraft rising from Cape Canaveral, from Baikonur Cosmodrome, from Vandenberg. No more internet. No more social media. No more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches, cries for help and expressions of contentment and relationship status updates with heart icons whole or broken, plans to meet up later, please, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others. And in so doing, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars. That's from the opening of Station 11, a novel by Emily St. John Mandel. It's a story, a novel that's set in the near future, a future arising with not a little amnesia from a devastating plague that has wiped out over 90% of humanity across the globe, as if anyone can really determine that number, 90%, 99%, 95%, a lot of people. A plague more severe than the Black Plague in the Middle Ages or the Spanish flu that devastated the world during and after World War I. Our story slingshots from the days and weeks before, during, and just after the days the Georgia flu swept through the world to the post-apocalyptic world, now a borning, some 20 years later. A world where survivors of that devastating flu are entering middle age. And youngsters are growing up with no personal memory of the lost world, though they live within their elders' too frequent and so unwanted references to their remembered past, amidst the physical anecdotes that remind them of a world now unknown, of TV, of internet, and plastics. A world of decrepitude, and yet a world of wonder, especially in those first few days after that overwhelming tragedy of the Georgia flu, when it became oh so clear to those who survived that things were going to change forever. Here's a glimpse at that world. This is just a few days, maybe a week, after the flu has devastated the world and the Midwest in particular, where our tale is set. Jivan resolved to follow the lake. The beach was all gravel and rocks, difficult to walk on in the snow, in the twilight. He was afraid of twisting his ankle, and he didn't like the footprints he was leaving, but he was determined to stay off the roads, if he possibly could. He wanted very much to avoid other people. On his last evening in the apartment, he'd stood by the window, watching the expressway through the telescope. In 3 hours of watching, he had seen only two people, both headed away from the downtown, furtive, glancing over their shoulders. In every moment of those hours, he was aware of the silence emanating from Frank's bedroom. He checked twice to make sure Frank wasn't breathing, knew the second time was irrational, but how terrible it would be to have Frank wake up alone. He'd felt a vertiginous giving away, the cliff crumbling beneath his feet, but held his sanity by sheer willpower. He wasn't well, but was anyone? While he was waiting for the day to end, he sat at Frank's desk, looking out at the lake, trying to hold on to the tranquility of these last few moments. Here in this apartment where he'd been for so long. Frank had left his manuscript on the desk. Jivan found the page he'd been working on, a philanthropist's thoughts on old movies and fame. Frank's impeccable handwriting in the top margin. I've been thinking lately about immortality. Was that Frank's line, then? Not the philanthropist? Impossible to say. Jivan folded the piece of paper and put it in his pocket. Just after sunset, he left the apartment. The dusty backpack that Frank had taken on hiking trips in his pre-spinal cord injury days. Its existence was something of a mystery. Had Frank imagined he'd someday walk again? Was he planning on giving it to someone? When the last light was fading over the lake, Javon pushed the dresser aside, stepped out into the terrible corridor with its reek of death and garbage, and made his way down the stairs in darkness. He stood for several moments behind the door that led to the lobby, listening, before he eased it open and slipped through, heart pounding. The lobby was deserted, but the glass doors had been smashed. The world had emptied out since he'd last seen it. There was no movement on the plaza or on the street or on the distant expressway. A smell of smoke in the air, with a chemical tinge that spoke of burning offices and house fires. But most striking was the absolute absence of electric light. Once, in his early 20s, he'd been walking up Yonge Street around 11 p.m., and every light on the street had blinked out. For an instant, the city had vanished around him, and then the lights were back on so quickly that it was like a hallucination, everyone on the street asking their companions if they'd seen it too. Was it just me? And at the time, he'd been chilled by the suggestion of a dark city. It was as frightening as he would have imagined it. He wanted only to escape. And yet, into this dark world, this world without electricity, without plastics, it's a world where romance blossoms in the midst of the everyday, in the midst of traveling through forests, around lakes, across streams. Indeed, day after day, the close proximity of the survivors now, a world where a small band of Shakespearean actors and symphony musicians can eke out a living wandering the byways, the highways are long gone, around the Great Lakes, seamlessly crossing old international boundaries. The concepts of the United States and Canada are less and less remembered relics of a past. Visiting the small communities of humans now making a new life for themselves in the abandoned Walmarts and high schools that dot the landscape. Discovering the goings-on in what used to be neighboring towns only when a wandering salesman or our acting symphony troupe happened to wander into town. Come soon to our stories, the remnant of our modern world. Or is it the ongoing manifestation of the human need and desire for certainty in the midst of change and upheaval? Our actors, our players come upon a once friendly town that has become eerily withdrawn and suspicious of outsiders. The town of St. Deborah by the Lake is dominated, the Shakespearean troupe soon come to learn, by a zealot who sucks all into his orbit of fear and damnation. Our lead characters take it upon themselves to delve into the maelstrom of the small encampment has fallen into, not the least in an effort to find two fellow actors, players, who have mysteriously disappeared from the small town after decamping from the troupe just a couple of years earlier. Friendships, you see, are rare enough in this new world for the folks still living to passively accept their loss. But our troupe of actors and musicians poking here and there rouse the suspicions, and soon enough the anger of this zealot prophet and his minions, putting our troupe in physical and emotional danger as their very lives are threatened and their long-won friendships and reasons to hang together or hang separately in their brave new world are questioned as they had never been before. Woven into this story of a dystopian future are the days of the seemingly glorious past, and in particular, the life and the work of a magnificently famous actor whose work was the emanating force for so many of our current actors and musicians' motivations then and now. Somehow, through the facility of her writing, our author, Emily St. John Mandel, pulls all of these characters and all of these storylines into coherent and motivating wholeness, painting a pair of worlds, the now and the soon-to-be, that keep us turning the pages. Her attendance to her character's experience of the sights, the sounds, the smells of the world past and the world now existing make her story seem truer to life than it ought to seem. And her ability to interweave the characters' real-life passions, their fears, their joys, their bitterness, give the story a true-life ring well worth experiencing. Finally, it is well worth noting that besides breathing life into the power of Shakespearean and symphonic mythos into the near future, Station 11 is Star Trek infused as well. Yes, Star Trek, the TV series Star Trek, the motion picture. The slogan, "Survival is not enough," is emblazoned upon the troupe's lead trailer, and it hails from an episode of the 1990 Star Trek Voyager series. And there is a not-so-hidden Star Trekian prime directive, look it up if you're not sure, that guides the troops' comings and goings as they travel the wilderness of this brave new world. Though every reader may not agree, I do think it is fair to ask if the ending of our journey into this alternate future is a fair resolution of the tale. Without giving away the final pages and the climax of Station 11, let's suffice to say that the evil that infects this novel seems to get its comeuppance. Let's finish with a key part of our story, where the traveling troop discover they have a stowaway on board from that zealot-led town from which they have just run. They encounter a young girl named Eleanor, who had hidden herself in one of the caravan's storage containers and has just been discovered. The leader of our band, the conductor, begins to interrogate the stowaway as we join the story. What to do with Eleanor? They knew they risked accusations of kidnapping, and they had long adhered to a strict policy of non-intervention in the politics of the towns through which they passed. But no one could imagine delivering a child bride back to the prophet. Had a grave marker with her name on it already been driven into the earth at that small town? Would a grave be dug if she returned? Nothing for it but to take the girl and press on into the unknown south, farther down the eastern shore of Lake Michigan than they'd ever been. They tried to engage Eleanor in conversation over dinner. She'd settled into a weary stillness, the watchfulness of orphans. She rode in the back of the first caravan so that she'd be at least momentarily out of sight if anyone approached the symphony from the rear. She was polite and unsmiling. "What do you know about the Museum of Civilization?" they asked. "Not very much," she said. "I just heard people talk about it sometimes." So Charlie and Jeremy had heard about it from traders? "Also the prophets from there," she said. "Does he have family there?" "I don't know." "Tell us about the prophet," the conductor said. Eleanor told them he'd come to St. Deborah by the water not long after the symphony had left Charlie and Jeremy there, in the head of a sect of religious wanderers. The sect had moved into the Walmart at first, a communal encampment, in what had once been the lawn and garden department. They told the townspeople they'd come in peace. A few people were uneasy about them, this new population with vague stories about travel in the South and the territory once known as Virginia and beyond. Rumors held that the South was exceptionally dangerous, bristling with guns, and what might they have done to survive down there? But the new arrivals were friendly. Luli. public library.